intertextual cardboard experience.
We've got a trilogy. 3 episodes, 3 intros, and 0 chapter sound effects. This will be the shortest intro yet, though, as this is the perfect ending to this mini-series. So, let's get on with the show.
Hello, and welcome to Intertextual Cardboard Experience. Very excited to have our serene 19th guest today in designer Brett J. Gilbert. How are you doing today?
I am very well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we just chatted for a second before coming on and just giving a little bit of context. This is kind of now the third episode in a trilogy, and previous guests to start off that trilogy were Trevor Benjamin and David Thompson. And when I had Trevor on, he mentioned that being the 17th episode that he was a prime number, but we're we're prime as well with 19. So I think it's kind of meant to be that, you know, two of these three numbers are prime. So it's all meant to be.
I mean, that is the maximum number of 3 consecutive digits that could be prime.
Yeah, that's the way it is. So yeah, I look
that math backed out.
I know. Well, if you start talking about math, that's going to break my brain. I looked, and the next time there would be 3 numbers in a row, and 2 of them would be prime, would be 29 and 31. So that's a whiles away, but
something to work towards.
Yeah, something to work towards. But yeah, I guess it was serendipitous that it worked out this way, because Trevor mentioned it, and this one is as well, and it gets to bookend some thoughts. But
okay, so the third in the trilogy, the final act.
The third in the trilogy, the final act. And that actually leads us pretty well to not like a curveball question necessarily, but any medium, what is your favorite trilogy? So it could be movie, series, book, anything.
Oh boy. Okay. My favorite trilogy. That is not something I've given a lot of thought to. Things that come in threes. I mean, it would, oh, man. I mean, here's the thing. I'm old enough to remember when Star Wars was new. I am old enough to have gone to the cinema to see Star Wars in 19, well, it would have been early 78, I assume, when it was brand new. And, you know, it was like nothing, unlike anything else in the history of cinema, well, certainly that I had seen. I mean, I was only 7, so I hadn't seen that. I hadn't been to the cinema very often. So I guess I can't think of any other trilogies that I've been particularly attached to, I suppose. Not that I'm a huge Star Wars nerd, just to be clear, but I am of that age. I am of that age.
Okay. It's an interesting thing, too. So I think a lot of trilogies wind up being linked to, like, a genre. So, I mean, Star Wars being sci-fi, now there's three sets of trilogies.
Indeed.
For that, but you know, sci-fi, fantasy, I think one of the bigger ones, which I'm not into any of these a ton necessarily either, but you know, Lord of the Rings is a big trilogy too. But I like the Star Wars pick, and honestly it was one of the ones that I had written down as kind of an honorable mention for myself, just because I didn't really have a set answer, but I find myself watching A New Hope, or at least like starting to watch A New Hope for various different reasons throughout the years. And I don't know, it's a good film. I really like that movie.
I mean, funnily enough, though, and this was, I hadn't really thought about it until just now, I did actually rewatch A New Hope relatively recently. And it is kind of showing its age. I mean, it's pretty, it is a bit ropey in places and incredibly slow. but that's just because, you know, cinema has moved on. I mean, it's still an absolute classic, of course, but it doesn't necessarily hold its own against, you know, I don't know what the younger generation make of it now. They probably think, but it's incredibly old hat, I assume.
I could see that. I don't know. There is just definitely a level of humor and charm that it's well balanced in my opinion.
Oh no, I take nothing away from it. God knows, it's just At some point, you maybe have to stop watching the same things over and over and expecting them to be just as good as they always were. You know, it's, what is it? 40 plus years old. It's kind of crazy to think that. Yeah, well, when I went to see it, we weren't watching movies from 40 years ago. That was pre-war 30s stuff. That wasn't that wouldn't have held anybody's attention, at least not of the younger generation.
Yeah, that's true. Well, very, very fair thought. And just kind of another, I don't know if it's if you technically would deem it a trilogy, but pretty soon you have the third game coming out in the Mandala line.
Indeed.
So that, I'll say once that comes out, it'll be one of my favorite trilogies too.
That's very generous of you to say that, given that you've not played the game yet. No, I mean, we're certainly excited for that. And it's kind of, it's unexpected perhaps that one game has generated that kind of, has turned itself into a line. But it's been fun looking at, yeah, finding ways to reinterpret the ideas, I suppose, in it. And in some ways, the third game, Flowers, is closer to the original idea we had for the game as a multiplayer game before it crystallized into a two-player card game. So we started trying to make a multiplayer card game, and it sort of failed. But we had to go on a long journey to return to it. I mean, it's different from what it would have been had we made it, you know, originally. It's sort of interesting, though, that it's continuing to evolve.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. So yeah, just kind of, well, re-familiarize, or if anybody's hopping into this episode before listening to the previous ones, both episodes, I think we talked about Mandala and Patterns, because David talked about those two games being ones that he's played a ton lately as well.
And... Indeed, yeah, he's been very vocal about, I think, to his audience, of which he has quite a significant audience, about both games, which of course is fantastic, because I'm happy he enjoys them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Mandala being the first game and Patterns being the second, with, you can correct me, but I think obviously the biggest similarity between the two would probably be the scoring, end game scoring conditions, and trying Indeed. To figure out how you can maximize some of the higher points, like one through six is what you can score for each color.
Yes.
But also, I mean, I think just kind of the, if I'm not mistaken, one of three kind of options of things that you can do on your turn, basically, in order to manipulate cards in Mandala or little tokens in Patterns. So,
I mean, both games and Flowers is the same, are very lean in terms of rules. I mean, that's something which both Trevor and I strive for, I guess. And I think we got lucky with Mandala that two, because it didn't arrive fully formed, it didn't just turn up. I think we had the idea for the card play before we had the idea for the scoring regime. And when we first thought of it, I think we weren't really sure that it was going to work. We didn't think it was that structure. We thought maybe that structure would be too limiting or not interesting enough, or, you know, it would need more work. And it was sort of fascinating to see that actually a really simple structure attached to a really simple set of, well, binary choice when you play cards, essentially, led to a really interesting strategic game in a way. It was richer than we expected it to be. You have to, you know, it's a little bit, it's sort of alchemy, isn't it? Like you put two things together and you realize it's more than you expected.
Awesome. Yeah, I think, I'll probably say it so many times. I mean, I love Mandala. My experience with Patterns has definitely been less. It's newer, and sometimes it just takes me a while to get a new game into the circulation. But I like them both a lot, and I love Mandala. I told Trevor that for me, if I were to drum up a top 10 list right now, that game is on it. So,
Right. I mean, that's always fantastic to hear. It had a really good reception. Lookout did really well with it, and it's had a good. I mean, hopefully, it will continue to have a life as well. And I think following it up with patterns and with flowers will just make all of the games hopefully continue to find an audience. So fingers crossed. But certainly, we had a lot of fun developing each of the games and exploring sort of how to maintain some of the like preserve some of the DNA, I suppose, but still make something new. And fingers crossed for Flowers that it's lighter. It was designed to be lighter and more approachable, faster playing, and it does, it doesn't use all of the DNA. It has six colors, of course, because that was kind of hard coded. And I don't know whether you've seen the images of the game yet, but it will be out soon. So there is a nice big cloth play mat, and there are three sort of areas that you play into, which are the flowers, instead of two. But it was really it was an interesting game to work on because we kind of knew what we wanted it to be, but we weren't entirely sure what that was. So we kind of had a framework for it. We kind of knew when we were straying too far. It was like, oh, well, that's not going to work. That's outside of what we want it to be. And I mean, in the end, it came together quickly, but of course, it didn't come from nothing quickly. It came from a sequence of decisions, and patterns was part of that process as well.
Yeah, that's super cool too. I mean, especially 'cause I mean, as you mentioned at the onset, that the idea of having the game be multiplayer from the start, so that idea was there, and you're kind of working from there, and then kind of brought it all the way back to this, so.
I mean, certainly when we've worked on many games together, and it's more often than not we get to a point of going, maybe this is just two players. Maybe we can't make multiplayer games. They're different beasts. They're really hard, and a two-player experience, playing two players rather, is going to be very different from playing multiplayer, even in a multiplayer game. Like the head-to-head nature of it means that the game feel of the game is going to be different. And sometimes you just can't scale. You just can't make the same experience work in both domains. And it's not quite a cop out, but at some point it's like, well, let's just focus on this being a two-player game and see whether we can make it work. I mean, the joy of working with a collaborator on two-player games is you don't actually need anybody else to play with. You have all the playtesters you need in the room. So it's like, well, we'll play it and we'll figure out. And if we like it, great. And sometimes, certainly, we've tried to build big games, or we've taken a two-player experience and speculated on whether we could expand it into a multiplayer game. And often it's just lost what we enjoy about it. But Flowers is an exception to that, I think, that we focused on making it on a multiplayer game, but we needed it to still work really well at two players. It wasn't a compromise. So at least we knew what we were trying to achieve. I think we knew what question we were trying to answer with that design specifically.
That's really neat. You mentioned nice for playtesting. Nice for me because then I don't need to find too many people to game with either. I can just rope one other person into the experience, and that makes it easy for me as well. So good stuff overall. But yeah, so I mean, honestly, just kind of in some of that introductory discussion, we've already started talking about some of the things that we possibly could talk about. The title, which I think I sent this to you in advance. Sometimes I have a title in advance, sometimes I don't. Kind of irrelevant, but this is going to be called Collab Restriction, a Collabstraction episode.
Very
Yeah.
good.
So kind of just like Patterns, a mandala game, or
Indeed.
but also borrowing from the previous two titles being Collabstraction episodes, and being able to talk about collaboration and abstraction, and then this case too. You mentioned it a little bit already, how the games that you and Trevor make, and you and like Matthew as well, we can talk about that moving forward a little bit too. You want to focus on making them lean, and I think that some of your projects and just in your design spaces that you're working in can lend to that type of conversation as well. But we'll get there. Did I? Okay. So my brain, usually by the end, I'm fuzzy. Did I mention that you mentioned you didn't listen to the previous two episodes? Did I say
I
that
have not
already?
Listened. I didn't want to sully okay. myself by muddying the waters.
So you're.
I will listen to all. I will have a trilogy of ones to listen to after the fact.
Super, super true. So once you listen back, you'll be able to go through all of them. But a couple of questions, primarily in the earlier collaboration section, and this first one here are kind of borrowed. Some borrowed, some repurposed. But to start it off, the Cambridge Design Group has been brought up a little bit. Unless my understanding of it is off, it kind of seemed like the two original members and designers were both you and Matthew Dunstan. In a second, you can clarify if I'm completely off there.
No, you're correct. You're correct.
Okay, awesome. But so then the question is, like, how has the experience with, you know, that group's growth, some movement of different members, and honestly, the tremendous amount of overall success and published games and partnerships. How has that experience been for you?
I mean, it's been the majority of my design career. I mean, it's been running for over 10 years now, I think. And it started small, certainly, but it started quite soon after my first game was published. And it was just one of those little accidental alignments because Matt had just moved to Cambridge as a postgraduate student. I was already based in Cambridge, but I didn't know the community. I mean, I'd begun to meet people elsewhere in the UK. I mean, it's a really, really good designer community in the UK. And the Playtest UK organization that's run by Rob Harris, which has now got chapters all over the country, that had relatively recently started up. And I've relatively recently met him and other people through him. And I've been to Essen, but it was all very new. It was still at the beginning of my design career. So it happened at the perfect time, I guess. And in the perfect place, it turned out, because, I mean, if you're going to go anywhere in the UK and find, you know, a bunch of nerds, then probably Cambridge is a good place to start. I mean, in my prehistory, I went to Cambridge as a student. I was a proper nerd. But it draws in people. You know, it's a center of, it's not surprising you would find those people there, but we got lucky, I think. And certainly Matt reached out to me because I had a blog. And it was probably before I was on Twitter, actually. And I talked about my games, and I talked about how I'd entered games into competitions, and I'd had my first game published. And I must have mentioned I was based in Cambridge, and he'd just recently arrived in the UK, in Cambridge, for his postgraduate work. And he was going to Essen for the first time, and I was going for Essen for the second time. So we actually met in Essen. And when we came back to Cambridge, that's when we started meeting. But that was before it became a thing on the internet that drew other people in. And so it started very small, but eventually we made the leap to add it to the Playtest UK meetup kind of schedule, as it were. And from then, you know, the rest is history, because that's how everybody else who has ever joined the group found us. And it has had a pretty big impact on all of our successes, I think. You know, and lots of people there have had games published, like David Thompson, for example, who joined the group. He was based in the UK for, I think, maybe only 4 years in the end. But, you know, that a lot of us went to Essen together. We went to other cons together. We designed together. We playtested together. And we did that every week. So although there were, and continue to be, really successful other meetups in the UK, we were the most regular. There was a monthly one in London initially, that was the beginning of it, but doing it every week made such a difference, because it was like doing your homework. It was like, right, I'm gonna have to, we're meeting next Wednesday, it was always Wednesdays, it's now Tuesdays, but Best to get my next prototype ready because there'll be an opportunity to play. And some weeks we only had four or five people, but that was every week, and I lived around the corner, so it was super convenient for me. I made sure it was super convenient for me. But I think one week we had, this was several years into it, we had like 18 people turn up, which was almost everyone who could possibly have come at that time. So it was almost too many people at that point. I was like, crikey, what do we do with this? But it was always very informal and very productive, and yeah, a real accident, I suppose, but a very happy one.
Funny. Yeah, you mentioned at the tail end, but yeah, when you said that as many as 18 people showed up, I was wondering what the maximum, like how many people at most had showed up to one of these meetups. How
I mean,
many?
that was almost too many for the venue. We used to meet in a pub, and they were very, it was a quiet night. It was a midweek, so I mean, they were happy for the trade, I think. But it was, and they were very, they knew they expected us, but we weren't big drinkers necessarily. I mean, they also ran a, like, it was a restaurant, and so some people did eat and drink there. But I don't think we were hugely good for business. Like, we weren't, they can't have been relying on our business to keep them afloat. But when 18 people turned up, that was almost too many. It was like, well, we have other clients. Like, we have to be able to seat people who are eating at our restaurant and paying the bills. You can't just have all the tables for your nerdy little play testing. But they were surprisingly generous and sort of accommodating. So.
So what? How many people would you say on average come to the weekly meetups nowadays,
Well,
2024?
now it's so obviously COVID kind of knocked it on the head for weekly meetups, and we're now back up to twice a month, so every 2 weeks. And quite often, I mean, normally there's six, seven or eight people over the course of the evening. And more than that, again, becomes a problem because we meet at a pub and we don't, it's not as if, they know they do recognize us coming, and they have a nice long table that we can sit at if we're there early enough, but we don't book anything, so we don't really have an agreement with them. But yeah, maybe 12 was the maximum, maybe last year towards, I can't remember exactly, but it's enough to have two or even maybe three groups playing something at the same time, which is fantastic because it means we can get through a lot of games.
Awesome. That's really cool. Having your insight and experience of just kind of seeing it from the beginning, and obviously a lot of change. I mean, you mentioned some of the members moving, and then obviously, COVID shutting things down too, and having it being back to bi-weekly since. So it's
No, I'm
neat.
glad that it's back up and running, and it didn't. And obviously, it killed all of those kind of meetups. And a lot of that, some of that moved online. People started using Tabletop Simulator. For example, I'd never used Tabletop Simulator before, so it was possible to play test with people. But it's very different to do that. And returning to sort of in-person play testing is a real treat.
Yeah, I can imagine. I still haven't learned how to use Tabletop Simulator, and
Well, you're not missing a great deal. I mean, it's a tool, a very inadequate tool, I suppose. It's way more than it needs to be for what I ever use it for. But I mean, it has its charms. I mean, you don't have to cut anything up or print anything out, and you can have as many components as you like, which, is great. I mean, you can iterate, I suppose, quicker than you could do in the flesh, but it's a different. When you play test online, it's very different from play testing in the real world.
All right. Well, I won't go out and try to learn how to use it effectively anytime soon. It's here.
No, I wouldn't recommend it, to be honest.
It's on my computer. I have it. But well, maybe out of necessity someday I will. But okay. Awesome. So kind of moving on to some of your designs and collaborations, just kind of a clarification question, first before getting to another specific question. But on BoardGameGeek, If you click on your name, there are 60 games, some expansions that are under your credits. I'm familiar with a bunch of your games. I clicked on most of the rest, but it appears as if the majority of your games are either co-designed with Matthew Dunstan, Trevor, some solo, and then a couple kind of different collaborations or different groups too. Is that a fair enough breakdown, or does that seem right, or am I wrong?
I mean, certainly, I think it's certainly true that the majority of them came out of the collaboration, or, you know, the long-standing collaboration with Matt, because we worked on a lot of games together. Some good, some bad, some indifferent. And, you know, we went to Essen year after year, and we built Acrobat Contacts, and we pitched and repitched. And eventually, when you ask enough people, some of them will say yes. And not every game is your best work. I mean, it can't be. And also, a lot of those games are now essentially seem like antiques to me. Like, they're very old. And I'm not saying I didn't think they were good at the time, but, you know, 2024 me maybe has a different opinion. But it's more about just turning up. I mean, that's just, I suppose that catalog is an example of that. The scale of it is a direct result of that collaboration, because I don't think it would have been impossible to achieve that much and pitch that often and get all of those things published on your own. Unless you had one line of games that was, like, you know, spawned 60 kind of other versions of itself, it would be almost impossible to do it on your own. Clearly, there are some very successful, you know, A-list designers out there who have been just as dedicated and just as, well, vastly more successful, mostly on their own. But that's the rarity, I think. It would be really hard to do that.
So here's a follow-up question that I didn't necessarily have, but just kind of popped up, was you mentioned that some of those earlier designs kind of feel like antiques to you, I think was the word.
Yes.
So which, I mean, you could pick more than one, but which game or you know, a couple of games from earlier in your design career do you either, you know, like, feels most like the current version of your design or matches up with 2024 you, and or is something that you would want to keep designing for? So either like a different version of it and get it out there again, or an expansion or whatever that might be.
Is it, can I check?
Yeah.
Can I bring up the list on the Amazon? Yeah. I suppose I could check on.
I was going
to
say.
Like, if I switch, if I switch to, I can check online, can't I? On my own website, which has all of my games listed on it. So the question was, which is the most sort of authentic to the current me, essentially?
Yeah, yeah. I would say that's what the question boils down to. If you can't tell, I just add a lot of random conditionals and follow-up questions before.
Here's the thing. I mean, I genuinely think my first published game, Divinare, which was a little bit of a, you know, alchemy of its own, came out of nowhere, won a contest, got picked up by Asmodee, as was, you know, got into the recommended list for the Spiel des Jahres. I mean, it's kind of crazy to think that that was my first published game. And I think it was, that holds up because it's sort of classical and very lean. So I think that one continues to be something that I'm proud of. And indeed it will have a second, well, it's going to have an edition in Japan, actually a new edition in Japan. A Japanese publisher has picked it up. I mean, it's the same game, although we did look at a couple of modest, tiny little adjustments. So I suppose in that sense, it's still live. It hasn't disappeared. Whereas I don't think many of my early games really deserve a second edition. I mean, the thing is, they're not disconnected from the later games. They're all part of that journey, aren't they? And some of them are more connected than others. Some of them contain in them the seeds of maybe what was expressed later. But I mean, that was a solo thing that I worked on solo, and it was, you know, it was my launch pad, I suppose. And it's such a, and it did really well. And I think I just got really lucky that I had an actually good idea at just the right time. I remember playtesting it for the first time. This is before playtest. I think it was possibly before I even knew playtest was a thing. Maybe it was before playtest existed as a sort of an organization. I had been introduced to some other UK designers through a sort of an online contact. And I went to a sort of an informal private gathering of some designers who knew each other already. And I was invited into their little world. And I took the first prototype of that game, but I'd only just designed it. Like, it was just a little thing that popped into my head literally the week before. And it wasn't terrible. You know, it was already quite good. It already worked. It already had a shape to it and a kind of a life to it and a kind of a sense of what it was. It wasn't done completely. There was some work to do to finesse it, but I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't have a lot of experience, but there continue to be design contests. And so at that stage, I was trying to create things to submit to design contests because that seemed like a really good discipline. And this was a project that was a really good candidate for those kind of smaller, it was a smaller game, you know, it felt like it was decent, decent enough at least to enter into a contest, and the rest is history. And it's meant that it, you know, it won that contest, which was really surprising, especially given it was a Spanish contest and all the other contestants, I think, or other entrants were Spanish. So I beat out all of the Spanish designers to win this contest in Spain. And it was picked up and then published. So it was all, you know, it was a perfect introduction. I got really lucky, fundamentally, just to be clear. I was just super lucky. And, you know, this is more than 10 years ago. What is this? 12, 13 years ago. And there weren't nearly as many game designers out there trying to make a name for themselves. I mean, you know, the hobby is completely transformed in that time. So I still think it's good. But a lot of the other ones, not so much, if I'm honest, not so much.
But I mean, you already mentioned it too. You said that they are still a part of like that full journey, and the things that you are working on have obviously led to where you are, and whether it's just kind of, you know, sharing some DNA with earlier games or learning from some of the design choices or just, you know, kind of figuring out and going.
Oh, for sure. No, I mean, I think you have to develop your own kind of voice, don't you? I mean, I think I've detected that. I mean, it becomes hard in some ways. It becomes harder and harder to create things you're happy with because you're more critical, perhaps, of your own work, which I think is a necessary, you know, it's a necessary talent to develop. If you don't know anything, you'll settle for anything. You don't know that it's wrong, or you don't know it's, you know, you don't know that it's been done before. You don't know that you don't have a framework to put it into. So. Every game is part of that, and you can bring it to bear on new design decisions. You can reflect on aspects of older games that you've worked on. But they, very few of them necessarily deserve to be gone back to. They are steps on the journey, but you don't need to, you know, you don't need to return to them. You can't. In a way, you can't spend your time reflecting on poor decisions, perhaps, or the lack of clarity you brought to a design or some aspect of it that you were, in the end weren't happy with. It's done. Somebody published it. It has an audience. Some boxes got sold, maybe not as many as you or the publisher would have liked. Now it's on to the next thing.
I do think it's super cool, though, that, you know, you told the story of Divinair and how successful that was right away between, you know, winning that competition, getting picked up, and then being recommended by the Spiel des Jahres jury as well. It's neat that, you know, right from the get-go that you had that intuition for that, you know, for your designs in general, and it worked. You know, I think that's just like a cool, fun bit.
I mean... It's kind of surprising to reflect on it a little bit because I couldn't have expected it to have been so successful. And once it had been published and once it had been, on the Spiller's Jar recommended list, then it was a great calling card when we did go to Essen and we met with publishers, because it already had, it was already out there, and they might have even seen it. Indeed, the very first pitch meeting that Matt and I went to when we went to Essen to pitch our first game, I think we, it was the year after we met, and we went back to Essen. We had one game that we co-designed, and we pitched it to sort of like 13 publishers, because we'd talked to everybody we knew in the UK and got as many contacts as we could. The very first meeting we had was with Wolfgang at Cosmos. And this was, you know, brand new. I'd not met with any publishers before in that setting. And the first thing he said was, "My friend really likes your game." My friend, Michael Rannick, who's another, who's a German game designer, who obviously Wolfgang knows very well, was, he sort of went out of his way to point out how he really liked it. So that was a really good start. And as I say, a great calling card. So it was already out there in the world. It's, yeah, it was the best possible kind of beginning, I suppose.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, I'm glad that it did work out in that way. And it's just, you know, and has led to all the other future designs then too, because then I get to play them. So,
but indeed, but not all of them.
Well, so, not all of them. Sorry.
I mean, I wouldn't recommend you playing all of them, even if you could locate boxes. Just concentrate on the good ones. That's, okay. You know,
I'll do that. Don't worry. And then cool. I'll. Okay. Cool. So, okay. Here's where we get the fully recycled question. So three episodes in this trilogy, and the third time it's being asked. Okay. And it's regarding your role within your collaborative partnerships. So in, and you have to come up with a title that you would give yourself that best fits your role. So I'll tell you what technically Trevor and I worked towards his title or his name for his role, and that is the Grim Reaper.
Oh my word. Okay. It wasn't the kind of taxonomy I was expecting, but go on.
And then for David, he came up with the title Middleman for...
Really?
Well, in the context of abstraction. So he was kind of thinking about his role, like when he would, you know, do design work, or when he does design work with Trevor, that he's a little bit more into, you know, historical or setting, less abstract games. But then some of the other people that he'll work with are more into the, you know, like heavier history or less abstract. So that's kind of what he...
Oh, he sees himself sort of somewhere in the middle of that spectrum.
Yes.
Okay. So that I understand. That's a reasonable way to pitch yourself. What was Trevor talking about when he, well, and you collectively described him as the Grim Reaper?
Okay. So I'll spoil you some of the parts of that episode. So he mentioned that, you know, kind of, you know, different partnerships will yield kind of like different, or he'll take on different roles. So there's a funny bit when I was talking to Trevor where he says something along the lines of that he tells David when he's working with him, that him, David, is getting a worse version of you as a co-designer. Something like that. I mean, the words might not be 100%, okay. But...
Okay.
But the Grim Reaper then came about was kind of, I think, specifically when working with David, but then also kind of like the two of your focus in what we mentioned in terms of, like, you know, leanness in just like chopping things out, trying to get like a rule book shorter, or
right,
or trying to, you know, take a mechanism and seeing where it could be streamlined, things like that.
Oh, and he considers that's the role of Grim Reaper, is,
well,
chopping away with this enormous size.
Yeah. Yeah. I technically like came up with that name, but I was envisioning him with the rule book, just like you said, with that.
I see, okay. I mean, certainly when I'm working with him, we're both attempting to do that. I think we're both classicists. We're both seeking like the simpler, the simplest version of whatever idea we might be exploring. I mean, I always think of my role as being more of an editor, I suppose, or closer to a developer in a way, because I think most of the seed ideas for games that I've collaborated on have come from the other member of that collaboration, the actual genesis of a game, unless it's come from outside of us and we've sort of essentially been commissioned to think about something or a publisher has asked us a question. I don't think I'm very good at that. Like, that's really hard, just to be clear, and I don't think I'm very good at it. I mean, it has happened. I have had original thoughts. But of course, part of the skill is knowing what to do with that when you've had an idea, isn't it? And I think that's why collaboration is so powerful, because you don't want all members of that collaboration to be stepping on each other's toes. You do want complementary skills. And I think Trevor does, and certainly this is true of Matt. Matt was constantly having ideas. He couldn't contain himself. It was always like, I've got four ideas. Let's pick one to work on. It's like, I saw you last week. You didn't have four ideas then. What's happened? I can't quite comprehend that, the fecundity of that kind of just inspiration. And they're not all brilliant, but everything's got to start somewhere. And Trevor's definitely better at that. But I think how we work together is more experimental now. Like, we can put something very limited or unclear on the table between us, and we can work out, or we can work together to figure out what it could become. But I think I am more of an editor, and I think sometimes that gets in the way of just the sort of the sheer kind of the creativity of it, because if you're not too careful, you start thinking too far ahead to the number of components or the box size or something about the audience or something about the rules, even before you kind of know what you've got. Because certainly I think one of the first things that I do when I'm working on an idea is to write the rules down, because in writing the rules down, that helps me to clarify the idea in my head. Now, and so it's always bewildering to me that other designers don't write the rules down until the end. So, well, what do you mean? How could you possibly remember all of the elements of this idea? And what if you forgot some of them? And how can you know what it's going to look like on the page if you don't actually try and put it on the page? Because it's no good having an idea if you can't communicate it. It has to be translatable to an audience through a rule set. You're not going to be in the room with them. And so by writing rules down, for me, that's normally the first step. I mean, not the very first step, but that's the first step when I feel like I've got a handle on it, I guess. And I suppose that's where the being an editor literally comes in, because you have to describe everything in words, and you have to find a form of words that reflect the gameplay. And that's a really important step, because I used to work in publishing, and I used to be an editor of sorts. I was more of a project manager, but I did do copy editing, and that was a really useful skill actually to develop, because it's really helpful when working on rule sets. Now, I used to think I was quite good at writing rule sets, and maybe I'm at least maybe I'm better than most, but I don't know that I'm as good as I think I am. And actually, because when Trevor and I work together, I always write the rules, partly because I kind of enjoy writing the rules, and one of us has to do it, and might as well be me. But I think when he works with David, Trevor writes the rules.
That's funny.
So it's interesting. You have to find your place, don't you? But when I say editor, that's part of it, literal text editor. But it's, yeah, you can't not, you have to choose, I suppose. Design is curation, isn't it? Design is choice. And a seed of an idea could literally be anything. It could go in tons of directions, and you have to choose one of them. And I think maybe when I worked with Matt, that was most of what my contribution was choosing. I think it's a bit different with Trevor now. I mean, I think it's all very muddy anyway, but I think we're a bit more experimental. Like, we try and see where an idea takes us, I mean, all of those, every single choice, you know, every single moment you make, you decide to go left instead of right, is making a choice. But it, you can't, I mean, it's, we're doing it together. Like it's happening in real time. It's not just Trevor says something and I go, it should be this. It's like, right, let's make it like that. It doesn't happen. That's no good. but if one of them's a Grim Reaper and one of them's a middleman, I mean, being an editor, that sounds, that's really dull, isn't it? I mean, that's admin.
I mean, you brought up another
back office stuff, isn't it?
You said curator. That's
curator. That is better, actually. No, I quite like that. That's a good point, actually.
And that was
curator. Oh, I quite like that. I'll take that.
Okay. Yeah, I was gonna say, I was gonna ask you, I'm like, are you gonna settle on editor? Or I mean, you did bring up curator and I feel like it.
That's a much better word, isn't it? That's a much, because it's much more romantic kind of term for it. All designers are design, as I say, the act of designing something is making a choice. Even if you're curating from your own, you've come up with a set of options yourself in your own head, you have to pick one of them. You can't do everything. At least that's would be my view. But that is a skill, certainly. That is a skill. And curating rules, perhaps, is another element of the work that has to be done to crystallize an idea into something that can actually be made.
Yeah. What one of the things that I was thinking about when you're talking about kind of your approach to the design process and where you want the rules to exist and when you want them to exist and obviously, you know, them changing throughout that process too, was that you're probably not going to have any games on crowdfunding where you make this big splashy page and then there's like a little link that's going to say rule book coming later or something like that.
No, I mean, that's not my style. I mean, I would be scared to death if somehow that was set up. It's like, shit, I don't know what it's going to be. How are you selling it? I mean, it's sort of, incomprehensible to me that you could sell a board game like that. But it's which vector do you choose? I suppose you can come at it from very different ways. And most of those kind of games are very theme led, aren't they? And I mean, Trevor can speak for himself, but I don't think either I or Trevor are exactly theme-first designers at the best of times. And obviously, David very much is, because his interest in histories and sort of the historicity of the games he makes is so important to him, and so important to the players as well. But that's not, Trevor and I don't operate like that.
Yeah,
that's always second or completely absent, I suppose, which is, that's fine, but that's why typically our games are classified as abstracts, because they don't really have or need a theme. They are constructs. I mean, a good theme or a very light theme can help. The presentation is important and the language you use to describe the game is important and helps players to play. And curiously enough, Mandala was never conceived of. It didn't start out as a thematic game. I think we found Trevor absolutely came up with the idea for the Mandala theme and the name of it. And it really does fit the mechanism. Like there's a way of marrying those two things up. And some people look at Mandala and see it as thematic, as if that was our intent, which I'm sorry to say to those people, it was not. And some people look at it and go, all this language they've come up with, that's just in the way. Like, what the hell is that? That's just a waste of time. This is a field and it's a mountain and here's a river. It's like, get over yourselves. It's just colored cards. And I can see both sides. I love that there are people who embrace the theme, or at least the narrative of the game. The theme is a bit strong for what it is. But I also get where people are coming from when they say, you must be kidding. Of course it's got no theme. Look at it. It's a tea towel with colored cards on it. How can that have a theme? So and that's fair. Like both of those judgments are fair. But that's not where we started.
Okay. Cool. Well, you gave me an idea and I think I'm going to touch on it later. But I kind of wanted to get to a little bit of the line of questioning regarding, some of your, design goals and philosophies by way of your site. And I know that, as you mentioned, that it's, I'm not even sure what I put the word down, but that, it's kind of like archived. It exists, but I'm talking about Good Little Games. Right. That it's legacy. I actually didn't scroll to the right part, but it is in the past, but it was also where Prey Another Day had its start, had its beginning as well.
Indeed.
But before kind of talking about that a little bit, my question then is, what inspired that site as a project and the games that you designed there? And, despite kind of being done working for games specifically, for Good Little Games, what takeaways then do you have from the experience or experiment or whatever you want to call it?
It's quite some time ago, actually. And the original, like the micro game. So I designed a game called, which is on the site, called The Other Hat Trick. But that was, again, really early in my design career. And it was designed to be a micro game, as in, what's the minimum number of cards? It was going to be a card game, but what's the minimum of cards I would need to make a game? And it happened to be 17 for that game. And that's very close to, that the notion of a micro game didn't quite exist in the way that it now exists. And obviously it's been embraced and expanded upon enormously. And it's a big field now, and that's great. Print and play is bigger than it used to be, much, much bigger than it used to be. So maybe we were slightly ahead of the curve, and we didn't exactly capitalize on that as well as we could have done. But it sort of morphed into, I can't really quite remember what inspired me to reach out to other designers to say, well, look, I've got a print and play game that I want to kind of get out there. What about you? And try and define a limit to the number of cards. So it's like, well, it has to be a micro game. It's got to fit on like two or three sheets. What can you do? And some of the other games were inspired by that question, or they were games that other designers who I'd met had already come up with, but they didn't have an outlet for. And it was only later that Matt and I picked it up and started working on the Good Little Blank games, which came out in a row. But it was always an experiment, I suppose. And it's interesting to, well, some of the good little ones were, how do you shrink an idea down? There's already a catalog of games in this genre. How do you build a game with very few components, very few cards, and very few generic components that still capture some of the spirit of those larger games? So it was more of an intellectual exercise in a way, to see what could be done. It was quite a lot of work for each individual one, and some of them are definitely better than others. And I enjoyed making the artwork for them. It was, very basic, but I kind of enjoyed the creation of them as a process. And you're right that Prey Another Day, which has, done really well so far and hopefully will continue to do really well, is a product of that experiment. And had that not happened, then Prey Another Day wouldn't have happened either. So even though it's unlike the other games in that list, and it itself was inspired by a game that is not on Good Little Games, which Matt and I worked on, a simple sort of rock, paper, scissors bluffing game called Hawks and Doves, which we came up with. And Prayer of the Day is a distillation of that, in a way, a further distillation of something which was already pretty distilled. So it's all steps on a journey, etc. But I mean, I think we took it as far as we could at the time, and then it sort of lost. We moved on to other things. I mean, you have a roving eye. It was interesting at the time. And if people continue to play the games, great. But it's as you say, it's a legacy now.
Well, some of what you responded to there, I mean, I'm not saying that you can't be the curator, but you could also be the distiller. I mean,
Well, I mean, they're very similar things.
yes.
I mean, certainly, as I say, when Trevor and I work on games, we're both looking to try and make those kind of decisions to really take something simpler and make it even not simpler, but just more present it with the greatest amount of clarity, I suppose, that you can. And often that will be with the fewest rules and the fewest components, because rules and components are in the way. The rules are the least interesting part of any game, and they're the thing which people stumble over all the time. So if you can remove rules, you are making the game more accessible by definition to more people. And that has, I mean, that in my mind has to be the object. So that's the dream. The best game would be the game with no rules whatsoever, that everybody could play instantaneously and know and understand. But of course, there has to be some structure. But how little can you genuinely get away with? I mean, you look at some really successful games, and they're very, very lean. I mean, possibly Trevor brought up the same examples, such as like Dobble or Just One or The Mind. These are games which almost are barely there, rules-wise, and you can explain them in what, 10 seconds, and everybody can understand them. Now, they're not for everyone, and not everyone will enjoy them in the same way. But absolutely everyone can understand them. And that's why something like Dobble sells, what is it, 17 million units a year. And it's genius. It's actually very subtle. Like the way it's designed is incredible. It's just one idea. And it's a really good one. And so it totally deserves its success. But if you could wake up one morning from sort of a fever dream and have an idea with that kind of clarity, with that kind of precision, with that kind of accessibility, with that kind of universality, you'd be done. You probably could retire then. Well, you certainly could retire if you were getting double money. You wouldn't. I mean, somebody somewhere gets a really big check every month, and they good for them. They deserve it. But that is what I would hope is still ahead of me. You have to assume your best ideas are ahead of you, and I don't know what that idea will be. I haven't had it yet. But when I have it, hopefully I'll know what to do with it.
Yeah, it's funny because you mentioned Trevor bringing up some of those things, and then it kind of came up a little bit talking to David as well. But I'll just cap it. I'll let you experience that on your own. And you have my like stamp of belief. Like I believe that it's coming, and I'm looking forward to it all at the same
Well,
time.
so I believe it too. Well, you have to believe it, otherwise you'd stop, wouldn't you? But I believe it too, and I hope it's coming. But who knows what shape it will take? And if I could have that idea with somebody else and share it with Trevor, then that would be great, because it would be, we are constantly seeking ideas that we think can match those kind of levels. They're just really hard to do. You can't really work your way towards them from a larger idea. You can't start with something more complex, really large, and whittle it down to something that pure. That's unlikely. It's more likely to be either emerge fully formed ex nihilo. It's just like wait, literally from a fever dream. So, oh my God, that's it, isn't it? I find that's it. Write it down before I forget it. Or it will be a little. It will be a. An aside, it'll be like a little spark while you're discussing something else, while you're working on a different project, some other element of it will just sort of float off and go, oh, wow, that is a thing. That's a whole thing. Unexpectedly, you'll discover it rather than create it, I think. That's the process. Fingers crossed. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. But again, you don't even need me to cross my fingers because I believe. So
Thank you. That's good to
it's
hear.
coming. But okay. I mean, it's kind of. I mean, it is interesting though because I mean, obviously, kind of due to sharing that very similar goal and kind of design philosophy with Trevor is nice because then working on your games, you have like a very similar vision for the games that you're working on, and then, you know, like hopeful future games then too. But I don't know. I mean, this is not necessarily a question for you, but it's just like a thought kicking around in my head. I don't think that most, I don't know. I don't want to say most. I think there's a lot of designers who aren't necessarily doing that or trying to necessarily. I don't know. I mean, there's obviously there's like a spectrum for abstraction. There's a spectrum for like complexity.
I mean, if you look at the majority of games that are published in the hobby space, it's kind of clear that the majority of designers designing them aren't seeking that, because that's not what the majority of games in the hobby space do. It's not the audience they're serving, and that's fine. I mean, it's a different objective. The kind of products and the way they're sold and the way they're marketed and the audience to whom they are marketed to, you know, they have very different expectations in terms of complexity and component count and cost and, I don't know, sort of the scale of them are designed to be large. And that you know, they clearly do very well and sell a lot of copies, and people really, really enjoy those products, possibly in lots of different ways. It's like people buying kind of games with miniatures in them. Maybe they're just buying them for the miniatures. Great, they bought a toy. I mean, games are toys. You just enjoy the bit of it that you like. Nothing wrong with that. But they do rather stand opposed to the kind of things that I am interested in myself. And I find myself further and further away, a greater distance from those kind of games. Even a middleweight Euro is like an order of magnitude more complex than I could really care about now. I might understand them, like I get them, and I have designed them or worked with other people to design them at least, and that's fine. But they don't excite me. They're not for me. I'm not their audience. They're not for me. Maybe they never were, but they definitely aren't anymore. And so all of that, which is a big slice of the hobby, just is not my thing. Just don't try and sell them. I wouldn't play them and I wouldn't enjoy them. And if I did play them, as I said, I wouldn't enjoy them. I'd just sit in a corner being grumpy about them and sort of resenting the complexity that they present to me and the hoops I have to jump through to even get any one thing done, or they're not for me. And they are designed with a different outcome in mind. And I think that's good. I mean, it's good that as a designer, it's good that any designer to sort of realize with greater and greater clarity what it is that they truly want to create. And that's hard, and that's why it gets harder, because there are fewer and fewer things that you want to do, essentially, or it's a narrower focus. Still an enormous space that you could potentially design into, but your focus is clearer, and you know, you're less and less distracted by things you probably shouldn't have been doing in the first place. And you're hopefully a harder judge of your own creations.
Okay. I'm kind of going to backtrack a little bit, because I guess a question that I'll ask a decent amount is asking my guests about, you know, their gaming, you know, background and experiences and things like that. And I technically never did that here, but so following up to that thought, you mentioned that you like both design in and kind of enjoy playing games that are similar kind of to like ones that you design, just lean and to the point. What would you say the most, again, quote unquote, kind of like complex, what would you say is the most complex game that you have played relatively recently, or just have had played and enjoy? It's like, where does it get on that scale for you?
I did. I mean, this is a completely random bit of Eurogame kind of nonsense in a way. There was some friends of mine had a copy of the game called, oh boy, it's based on a book. Oh my word, my hold on, I'm gonna look it up. Sorry, get it right, otherwise I'll be just talking and nobody will have a clue what I'm talking about. Hold on. Can't even search for it because I can't remember what it's called. Oh boy. No, hold on. My mind is a blank. My mind is a blank. What am I doing? How many? Oh, it's got 2 R's. There you go. It must have 2 R's. I can't see. This is my, come on. There we go. Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. So this is that was a book. From, I don't know, probably a decade ago now. And Osprey, who published Undaunted, amongst many other fine games, produced a board game. This is like 5 years old. It's Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, colon, a board game of English magic. Huh. Now, this is not the kind of game I would ever normally put on the table or expect to enjoy. My friends had a copy. They hadn't played it. We played it. It took forever. I mean, it took them vastly longer than it should have done, about 3 or 4 hours. It should have taken, it says 60, 90 minutes or something. Incredible. I mean, and it's a Euro game, essentially, like it's Cubes and Contracts. But it had, like, we enjoyed it. We definitely enjoyed it. But I think that was because we were sort of willing ourselves to enjoy it. Like, we had to get through the rules. We had to understand it. We had to kind of decode it. And we did all get to the end of it and go, well, that took way longer than it should have done. It wasn't as satisfactory as, you know, it was quite hard work to get anything done. And even what we did do, it didn't seem very successful, but we did enjoy it because there was lots of story in it. It's based on a book and it was sort of redolent of this sort of Victoriana. And that's all, was all fun. And we enjoyed the experience of play, but it wasn't very rewarding as a game. And I would certainly not wish to play it again. But actually, and as a Euro, it's not even that complicated. I mean, it barely midweight is sort of light to midweight from a Euro perspective. What you were doing wasn't very complicated, thank God. Maybe we were just bad at it, or we didn't understand it, because we sort of wandered around Europe and visited various. Every card was either a person or an event in the sort of society of sort of upper middle class society of Europe at the time, and we sort of wandered about. Presenting, meeting people and presenting ourselves at various functions, and all the while being magicians, like actual magicians. The proposal in the book is that magic literally exists, but it's been hidden away and it's now being rediscovered. And we enjoyed it. So, and that's played it quite recently, but I wouldn't play it again. And it's within it exactly the quality of lots of other Euros, which I wouldn't want to play either. And it took way too long. Like, we could have played, you know, we could have sat and played Pray Another Day for 4 hours and had like 17 games of it. I mean, not 17 rounds. I mean, 17 entire games of it, and probably had much more fun. And so that's one of the benefits of simpler games. They're just quicker. You know, they just deliver. And even if they're not very good, it's like, oh, now I get it. I can go back into it and I can do it again. And they don't they're not demanding too much. They're not asking too much. I don't want to play games which are smarter than I am that sit there kind of wagging their finger at me and tell me, oh, well, you didn't do that properly, did you? It's like, calm down. I'll decide whether I'm enjoying it. I'll decide what I think is the right way to play. Some games are very didactic like that, and they have a very specific way that they must be played to kind of flourish. And you have rule sets which go, well, here are the rules, but there's little sort of literally a man, well, it's like Uwe, it's not, is it Uwe has little speech bubbles and he's sort of telling you what you should do in his game. So, well, you better do this. And it's literally, you better do this, otherwise it won't work very well. It's like, okay, why have you designed a game that you need to tell me how to play? Like, why can't I just experience it? I don't like, that's all of that's too much. and that was just, it was, but at least this, the Dr. Norrell, not Dr. Norrell, Mr. Norrell, the game, it had a sort of a life to it, I guess. Like the actual story was the story, the world of the story was quite richly drawn, and there was something to be enjoyed in that. And you could have played it, you could have gone really into it, I suppose, and played it much more like a role-playing game. And there's fun in that. Like there's a joy in that as well. But if I have to tediously collect resources to satisfy contracts to score points and then still do poorly just to get to the good bit, that's too much work. Sorry. I don't know whether it's not a particularly good example. I don't think it's a particularly good example of games in that space. But it was we did enjoy it.
Okay.
All of us.
Neat. Okay. So I'm gonna, like I said, I'm going backtracking. This is the least chronologically sensible placement for this question, but I am curious now.
Go on.
So what were some, you know, I mean, how would you kind of describe you know, I think a lot of people who, you know, play and design games later in life had experiences earlier in life. That's not necessarily all the case, but what would you say were the types of games that you remember playing when younger? And also, how did you decide or that you wanted to get into designing games based on some of the things that you were doing or playing when you did?
Well, I mean, we certainly played games as children, both amongst ourselves and with grown-ups, you know, as sort of in a family setting. That was something we did quite regularly. So there was a tradition of that in our family, you know, when we got together at Christmas, one sort of larger family gathering, sometimes we'd play cards for money. I mean, a very small amount of money, but the idea of playing cards as a group, you know, maybe like 8, 9, 10 people, was always something we did. So that kind of games in that kind of social setting was very common, I guess. I mean, that certainly I can fondly remember some games we had as kids that we played a lot of. I mean, there's a Sorry, for example, which is a classic Milton Bradley game. I don't know what kind, it's still probably for sale, maybe. I don't know. I mean, it was originally designed in the 30s or 40s, I think. It was kind of ahead of its time. It's Ludo, but with a deck of cards and sort of like tricksy little moves. We played that all the time. I remember enjoying that a lot. We played Monopoly. I mean, you know, that's because people played Monopoly. That's something people used to do, even though it's not a kid's game. Like, it's a really grim kind of game to play with children. I don't know why children... I remember playing it and finding it very upsetting. So I don't know why I was necessarily forced to play it, but it was on the table. We played... We had dumb kids' games, I suppose. We had physical elements, or you span a little spinning top, or you were playing doctors. There's a ton of cheap games, I suppose, and we made the best of them. Like, that's what we had. We didn't have very many, so we played them over and over. But to answer your second question, or the second part of it, the thing we did, which I think led on to becoming a game designer, is we changed the rules. We house ruled it. We did more than house rule it. I mean, everybody house rules, and that is essentially one step, but very, you know, it's a sliding slope. So the thin end of the wedge of becoming a designer is to actually decide, I don't like that bit, we're going to do it like this. That's design. That's the same process. But we took it further, I think. And it didn't occur to us that we shouldn't do that. We didn't feel, I don't remember, it didn't feel very transgressive to change the rules like that. We had a copy, and this was later when we were a bit older, I suppose. There was a game called Super Cluedo Challenge. I think it was called Super Cluedo Challenge. And it was a version of Cluedo, but with more people and more weapons, played on a bigger board. And it had a different system for decoding the... You still asked questions, but there was another system layered on top. And you sort of ran around this board. And it could take a long time to play. And what typically happened was you'd play for 2 hours and then everybody would come to the same conclusion at once. Because if you kept meticulous notes about everything that happened and every question and every answer, you could all basically come to the same conclusion at once. But even that game wasn't the game that was in the box. I think we played it once, but based on the rules in the box. And then we instantly transformed it into something there was sort of a hybrid between regular Cluedo, which we'd never had, and this new version. And we wrote, my sister wrote, hand wrote the rules out. And that was the game we played. We always played by those rules and not by the rules in the box. And they were quite different. I mean, they had similar aspects, but we somehow decided instantly that it should be like this. And that's what we played. So nobody else in the history of the world has played the game like we used to play it. We played it all the time. And we kept in the most absurd part of it that we really enjoyed, which is the sort of insane little mini game that happened every now and again. So on the there was sort of a garden path around that manor. And every now and again, for no reason whatsoever, you just randomly all have to run to a garden ornament by rolling dice. Not real time. You would take turns to roll dice, and you had to drop down tools, drop what you were doing, and run off to the, you know, the sundial. And the first person to the sundial would be able to ask a question or get to look under one of the, you know, discover something about the mystery, and hence move the game forward. But these little mini games could last for 5-10 minutes, because if you landed next to somebody, it was just a roll and move. If you landed next to them, you could push them back to any other part of the board. So in theory, that little mini game could have lasted indefinitely. So you would have thought, like a classicist designer might have looked at that and gone, well, let's get rid of that. But that was the bit we really liked. So that's the genesis of being a game designer, isn't it? It's going, oh, I quite like that bit. Let's make a game that does that more and take out the bit I don't like, because, you know, it doesn't work for us. So, and that's the beauty of a, you know, a board game. It's all exposed engineering. You know, you can do with it what you will. You have the components and the cards and the dice and the pieces or whatever it is. You don't have to do what the rules tell you. That's just a convention. You can do whatever you like, and fantastic, you know. That's not how a lot of people view them. I think a lot of gamers want to know that they are playing games correctly, in quotes, reflecting the designer's vision. But you don't have to, is the point. And so anybody can become a game designer. And house ruling is obviously something that people are very familiar with, even in a very modest way, even if it's a very slim little change. But you just, if you, once you've taken those steps enough times, you've made a new game.
Nice. Well, I'm looking forward to one of your future game designs having weird racing mini games as a part of it.
Right. Maybe I should remember that, actually. I should write that down.
Okay. I have typically in my interviews, I do have a couple wrap-up questions, and those ones will go a little quick. But I had one final thing that was kind of like in the scope, and I feel like my scope for this one and where we've gone is just, it's been all over the place because of me and my organization. But you mentioned how, you know, for the most part, when you're thinking about a game design, that you're thinking about, you know, like the mechanics or the feel first, as opposed to like the theme or the setting. So the one kind of like final question regarding, you know, abstraction or setting would be, what do you feel is the one game where you perhaps led most with theme or had the world and the setting like in your mind as like a focal point for what it was that the game was doing?
Yeah. Oof. That's a good question. Not many of them. I mean, as in that were driven by my inspiration, I guess. I mean, working with other people, I mean, you know, ideas are brought to you, and they might have with outside or around them an idea of theme. And it's like, oh, great, that sounds like a good enough theme. Let's work with that. I mean, it's, I don't know. I don't know that, I'm just looking at the kind of catalogue on screen to try and think of one that was really taken forward by a specific setting and that was somehow part of it. I mean, outside of ones which were specifically commissioned, with preset frame within a preset framework. I'm not sure any of them were really not in. I don't think not in the way that you mean. I mean, for example, Matt and I designed a football game for Cosmos, which is the most bizarre and unlikely thing you could possibly imagine because neither of us are football fans. And obviously, that was it had to be a football game. So in some sense, it had to reflect aspects of football, at least the aspects we understood. Had to have a board, a little, you know, had to have a ball, had to have goals. It had to have people, players on the pitch. But that was designing to a brief rather than having, rather than bringing, rather than the creativity being, oh, I want to make a game about this and that, this being a story rather than about a mechanism or an experience even. So I don't know that any really fit that category, if I'm honest, outside of the ones that were commissioned. Which is, well, there you are. The answer is none, I
None.
suppose.
Okay, none.
Equally.
Hey, you know what? That's an acceptable answer. Oh, buddy. Okay, awesome. Okay, so like I said, I kind of end on a couple of wrap up questions, and you know, part of the podcast or the way that I have it set up is I want to be able to talk about anything. We started our conversation with movie trilogies, so
Oh yeah.
that was probably the least board game related thing that we discussed. But like I said, we can talk about whatever we want. And in this case, I am curious about a text, so literally anything, could be a game, book, show, movie, song, what have you, that's been stuck on your mind for one reason or another.
You mean now or at any point in my life?
Like right now, yes. Like what's something that you've recently, consumed that you're like, oh, I really liked that.
I mean, just like everybody else, I'd sit and binge watch things on Netflix and Disney, and they kind of wash over you and fill your time. And some of them are good and some of them are less good. But I mean, the most recent one I consumed, the most bit of media that I consumed recently that I particularly enjoyed and was Ripley on Netflix. Have you seen Ripley?
I have not.
So it's a series, it's an 8-part limited series, as they call it on Netflix, just to warn you that it's not like 7 seasons worth of it and it's finished, based on the Talented Mr. Ripley book by a thriller by Patricia Highsmith. So it's like a 50s, it was a series of books with this particular character in it. And there was a film in the 90s, late 90s, but this is a new interpretation of it. I mean, it's the same story. It's shot in black and white, and it's very stylized and quite mannered. But it's a psychological thriller, so I mean, it's stuff happens. And Ripley, Tom Ripley, the sort of the and is an anti-hero because he's the psychopath that you root for, essentially. Not to give anything away, like he's clearly the villain. You're kind of on his side, and you're constantly wanting him to get away with it. So it was very gripping, and if anybody's seen it, hopefully they agree. But I particularly enjoyed that, I suppose. Yeah, it was very, as I say, it was very. Lean is not the right word. That's completely incorrect. It's quite a rich story, but it was very precise, I suppose. It was very deliberate, and with the way it was shot and the way it was sort of acted and everything. So it was unlike a lot of the more mass-produced kind of corporatized stuff that obviously is also very enjoyable at times. So it was good to see something which had an opinion, I suppose. It was kind of had a very clear sense of what it was and what it was trying to do, and it was really, it was very bingeable.
Awesome. Yeah, I well obviously when you're talking I typed it in, and I've been behind on a lot of things that I want to watch or what have you. But honestly, I don't really have, in terms of shows, I don't have a huge back catalog of things that that were pressing. So that one, I don't know. I'm going to add it to the list. It sounds,
well,
it
I would
sounds
recommend
really
it.
Neat.
I would recommend it.
Awesome. Perfect. Well, I'll, like I said, I'll add to the list. Spring, I've got like another kind of crazy busy month coming up, but then after that, I think I can sink into a few more shows. So nonetheless, you'll get a report from me at some point in time.
I mean, I don't know how well it's been received by other people, but I mean, it's, you know, it certainly was very interesting, and unlike a lot of stuff that gets sort of churned out. You know, we live in a golden age of television and all of that. Like, there's an incredible amount of content, a lot of it very polished. So it stood out, I suppose, as being a little bit different.
Nice. Well, I mean, yeah, like I said, from your recommendation and from looking at it, I'm excited to have that on my list. So speaking of things to be excited about, we get the kind of final question. We've talked about Flowers, which you said is going to be releasing pretty soon. In talking with Trevor, he also mentioned that one of your co-designs, Snack Rabbits.
Oh, right. Absolutely.
Is going to be coming out as well. What else should people be looking out for from you in 2024?
Well, so Snack, Snack Rabbits released in German, at least in Germany, a little while ago, but
yes.
I don't know whether it's actually out in English or not yet. It's a good question that I can ask the publisher. So Matt and I have a couple of games coming out this year, actually, which have been in the works for a while. So there's a Alley Cat Games, that's a UK game publisher, who published one of our games before. They published our game Chocolate Factory. They're publishing a game called Happy Home, which is a polyomino game, but it's got a little bit of a twist. So it's not just about packing it's not about space filling necessarily. You've got a little home and each piece is a piece of furniture, and you're trying to design your perfect abode following certain rules, and pot plants and rugs and like couches and beds. And I mean, it's cute. It's super cute. And it's been in the works for a while, so it's sort of coming soon. So I think the publisher will have the first copies at the UK Games Expo, which is at the very beginning of end of May, beginning of June. Separately, we have a game with Plan B, which has been in the works for the most enormous length of time. Like, it's not quite a decade, but I mean, it's a game that we originally designed the very first version of 7 years ago or something. It's crazy how long it's taken. And it's been through various, it's been in the same, well, it's been in a continuous sequence of hands, because the game publishing industry is constantly churning, and companies become other companies, and people move to different companies. But it is coming. It is. So I think they will have it at Gen Con, although I'm not entirely sure. I've seen, I think I saw, well, I saw the cover and sort of like the rule set, the final rule set. So that's kind of exciting, because it'll be interesting to see what it's become. Like, it probably isn't quite the game I remember anymore. It's had a long, long life, and obviously some of that time was COVID, so that kind of changed perception of how long these things take. But it has been a long time in the works. It'll be interesting to see how it is received, because it's a weird thing that we designed, essentially came up with the idea of 7-8 years ago, and it's only now being realized, because that's a long time. the world has changed. We as designers have changed, certainly, but the industry has changed. Like, the audience has changed. What they expect has changed. So we'll be interesting to see how it comes out. And we have other projects sort of slightly further out. But it's, you know, there's always, and some smaller projects too. So maybe not for this year, but for next year, Trevor and I have been working on some smaller stuff. So, and maybe even a fourth member of the Mandala trilogy.
Oh,
maybe.
Then it's not a trilogy anymore. No.
Well, with no point did we establish it was going to be a trilogy.
Oh, but then it can't be a part of my favorite trilogies.
Oh, cute. Sorry. Well, it will be a long. It may not happen.
No, I want it to happen. I'm not like telling you not to make it happen.
Again, we designed a game which would be a fourth member, and it's in the hands of the publishers. So it may, and if it's it you know, and it's sort of, we didn't, there's no guarantee that it'll be published. We're
Well,
just hoping that it will be.
we'll say when it is, it will be like the Phantom Menace. It will be like the
That, to be fair, the Phantom Menace is now being kind of reappraised, isn't it? So people are
Yeah.
more reflecting more kindly upon the Phantom Menace.
I think so.
So we'll see, we'll see. we'll see. But that, I mean, if it were to be published, it wouldn't be until the middle to the end of next year, I would have thought.
Okay.
So
Well,
don't count any of those chickens just yet.
all right. Okay. Well, it's a future thing, but no matter what, any future thing game that you mentioned, and some of the other ones, and obviously the fact that you have these awesome collaborations and do a lot of work with your just in designing in general, there's a lot to look out for from you, and I'm really excited about that.
Great. Well, thank you thank you for saying nice things about Mandala. It's always nice to hear from people who enjoyed it.
I didn't talk about, there's a lot of things we could have talked about too in terms of other games that like Mandala Patterns, Great Plains, and all of them are just like beyond enjoyable. So I'll say more nice things about more of your games.
Great. Thank you.
And I do have a, this was actually a bit ago now, as that I found a copy that technically for me wound up being a pre-order. I know it exists already, but I will have Pray Another Day in my hands at some point in the future whenever it gets delivered to me. So
Great. I know a reprint is scheduled for very in a for the next couple of months.
okay.
So
Yeah.
it's hopefully we'll get a its release will continue and to expand.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking about your games and the Cambridge Design Group and Star Wars and everything else.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. It's good to talk.
Right, thank you.
Great.
Intertextual Cardboard Experience, the most
Triadic
podcast about board games and any other text that they connect to. Thank you so much for choosing to spend your time here. Any further support, such as sharing the show with friends, following the page's socials in the episode description, writing a review, filling out the feedback form, or doing anything else you can think of is greatly appreciated. Keep playing, watching, reading, listening, experiencing.